ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. My guest today is Richard Lawson. Richard has a long and distinguished career as an actor and master teacher that spans almost five decades. Some of his most notable work includes Steven Spielberg's Poltergeist, Stick with Burt Reynolds, The Main Event with Barbara Streisand and Ryan O'Neill, and countless others. He's also created one of the most forward-thinking schools in existence, the Richard Lawson Studios, which uses motivational and cutting-edge computer technology to empower people to achieve their dreams. Recently, Richard and his wife, Tina Knowles Lawson, have joined forces to establish the new Waco Theater Center in Los Angeles, a new creative center where art can occur. Richard, thank you so much for joining us today. There's so much we could talk about, but for the purposes of this conversation, I'd really like to focus on the theater center. And so first, I was curious how you and your wife conceived of the idea, and if you could help take listeners along for the journey and your decision-making process.
Okay, so first of all, Tina and I have been friends for like 38 years. She was my sister's best friend. So I met her, well, actually maybe 36 years, because Beyonce's 36 and she was pregnant with Beyonce when I first met her. And she would come to California and her and my sister would hang out. And we developed a wonderful sort of respect and regard for each other because she was, you know, one of the sweetest people in the world, and she was kind, and besides being like, you know, one of the most beautiful women I'd ever met, that she had a heart of gold, and she was always helping people, and she was considerate of others, and all like that. So we developed this early respect and sort of a quiet attraction. She was married, you know, so it was, nothing could happen in that regard, but there was nothing, nowhere it could go. So we became friends. I would go to Houston. She had a hair salon, a successful hair salon. I would go to Houston, and I would MC her shows. And then I went to Houston to do Othello, and she took care of Bianca, my daughter. And Bianca and Beyonce played together. So we knew each other early on. And then in 1991, my sister died. And then our relationship, even though it was there, we didn't spend as much time together because we didn't have the same sort of glue that bound us, you know. And then jump cut to 6 years ago or so, she was going through a divorce. And then my sister's other best friend, Monica, was a part of that friendship connection going all the way back. But Monica and Tina were now best friends now. So when she was going through a divorce, Monica called me and said, "Hey, do you know any guys? I want to introduce her to some people."
So you thought, well, yes. Sorry.
And I said, you know, well, what's the menu? What are you looking for? You're looking for intellectuals. You're looking for people you want to have fun with. You're looking for what? And so they described the whole thing. And I said, oh, okay. What about me? And they said, hell no. Simultaneously, in unison, they said, hell no. So anyway, but Tina and I reconnected, and I supported her through the period of her divorce. And then we started off just really as friends, connecting up with her. And then it just grew from there. And one day, you know, we were talking about she wanted to create a center in Houston, you know, dealing with helping artists and painters and writers and poets. And she wanted this center. She had a center when Beyonce and Solange first came up, that there was a center that she took them through that really helped to influence their path as artists. And she wanted to create one like that. At the same time, I'm a teacher, and I was talking about creating my own center. And we said, wow, isn't that interesting? And I told her, I said, you always need to create a space where art can occur. And she says, wow, what an incredible name. I'm going to jack that name. So when we got together, it was sort of a natural extension of what we were both individually doing. And so when it came together, it was a really symbiotic kind of thing because we had contiguous purposes, you know, very headed in the same direction, different tracks, but basically the same thing. And so it was just a natural extension for us to create this space where art can occur while we mentor young 12 and 13 year old girls and boys. And we also create a theater where we can come and do productions and have the kind of space where it has a flexibility so that we have an art gallery in the front. We have a theater that is also a screening studio where we can screen for 130 people. We have the seats operate like bleacher seats, so we can open the space up, even though they're not bleacher seats, they're flush theater seats, but it's called projectile seating. So it pulls back so that you open the space up, or it pulls out so that you have 100 seats. So we have this really flexible place that we can do so many different things, which we are doing, and also the Mobile Arts Theater, where we repurpose 4 40-foot vans. One will become a stage, the other two dressing rooms, and one is a control room. And we go to parks around the city, around the state, and around the country, and we do theater on Friday night, music on, live music on Saturday night, comedy and poetry on Sunday night. And that's the entertainment portion of it. And in the daytime, the edutainment portion is where we have fiscal literacy workshops, job fairs, health fairs, and we motivate people to be able to reconnect with their own communities. You know, it's to sort of rehabilitate the communities to basically depend on each other, you know. So that's long-winded to give you sort of the overview of how Waco was created.
It's amazing. I think one of the things that I find really interesting, and the design of the space speaks to that, is that it isn't only about one art form, but it's about sort of the arts in totality. And so that's very interesting to me. It's not an easy thing to put together something like that, especially when you've obviously designed a structure which is complex and flexible. How did you go about fundraising for this? And what were some of your philosophies in communicating your mission to people?
Well, the one thing that we want to do is to provide this space where I can use the relationship between my school. I have a school called Richard Lawson Studios, and I teach filmmaking. I empower people to achieve their dreams.
And this is not just artists, though, right? I mean, obviously you empower artists, but it's all walks of person to find their dream, correct?
Yes, people, period. You know, if you look across the landscape of the students that I have in the school, you'll find, of course, you'll find actors, directors, writers, producers, you'll find comedians, you'll find sketch artists, you'll find improv artists, you'll find children, but you'll also find dentists and doctors and lawyers and nutritionalists and physical specialists, business people, anybody who has a dream. I can empower them using acting technology to do so. And so, therefore, the art that I create, you know, I put the A in STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, and I add the A to it to create STEAM. And the purpose of this is so that the scientists and the anthropologists and the mathematicians and the engineers, with the use of some artistic sort of tools, can expand their minds and open up their imaginations so that they can think outside the box, even though those things are pretty precise. But they still, you know, in order to blaze the path of new discoveries and inventing new things and new approaches and new ideas to something, which is right at the core of innovation, that when someone has had the experience where, you know, they challenge the status quo, and you can only do that if you have imagination, that you can then reinvent the wheel. You know, you can certainly expand the wheel or realize that the wheel can be used for a lot of different purposes, so that, you know, you can find people in the realm of my alumni of students who have used that technology that they've learned here to expand their businesses. And you can go online and find that as a source of proof. So this place is really kind of a dream factory where we can go into South Central and get, you know, 25, 30 students where they come here. And if you ask them what they wanted to do with their life, they would tell you, I don't know, because they can't think outside of their zip code. You know, whereas if we help them if we open up the apertures of their mind and their possibilities and they see other things, and they start to expand their thinking and they see possibilities and they see something in some experience that says, oh, I can do that. And it gives them, you know, the wherewithal to do it. At the same time, people who come and see productions here will also be motivated to think outside the box, to challenge the status quo, to really feel and see things that will motivate them to say, wait, I never thought of that. You know, we don't have a social agenda. We have an agenda of helping people to imagine and to dream and then help them find a way to manifest those dreams.
So what kind of metrics do you give yourselves in terms of success? Is it like number of people that you've touched and influenced? Is it like when you look sort of your goals for the theater for the next 5 years, would you say we hope to accomplish XYZ thing? What are those measurements?
Well, in terms of the kids that we touch, that if we can, you know, we deal with a certain number of students. Like last year, our first year, we had 30 kids in the program. This next fiscal year, which starts July 1st, we're adding 30 more. So that'll be 60 kids in the program.
And that's located, that's the location in LA, right? Or is that including your weekend vans where you travel?
No, we've adopted a school called Kipps Academy, which is a nationwide school. But we've adopted this one school just because it's the economics. It is easier for us to go to one location and deal with a group of kids from one school as opposed to it being spread out across Los Angeles and then having to provide transportation to deal with, you know, the expanse of Los Angeles and traveling. This particular school, we love the teachers there and we love the kids there, and the school, all of the teachers care and they're really engaged. What we can measure are the changes that happen in these people's lives, the grade point average, the behavior, the vision, the projection, the dreams, the desires, whether they are maintaining a certain level of aptitude and whether their degree of respect increases, the amount of books they read, how the various, because we take them on field trips, and how these field trips expand their minds and their thinking, where we help some of these kids go from the eighth grade, because KIPP goes from zero to eight. And then they sort of fan out after they graduated from KIPP, do we help them get into a higher source of learning, the better high schools, the better academies, and that sort of thing. So in terms of the theater itself, in terms of the type of productions that we do, because we create a season, and the kind of material that we choose is material that will touch and will be felt by the people that we target in terms of the underserved communities. And so we're looking to put up, you know, plays and one-person shows. Like, we just had Debbie Morgan here who did a one-person show about domestic abuse and how that has been, you know, a sort of a family trait that has occurred, where her family and her mother suffered and her grandmother all chose men who were abusive, and she finally has gotten that monkey off her back. She wrote a book called Monkey Off My Back. And then Vanessa Bell Calloway did a play about Zora Neale Hurston, one of the great African-American writers back in the 20s and 30s. And the plays going forward, Charlie Parker, and to redo a play called No Place to Be Somebody, which I was in 50 years ago, which was the first Black Pulitzer Prize play, that we're going to redo that. And the musicals, Assassin, and then another play about cancer. So that our season is going to be filled with provocative material that really just causes people to think and to deal with certain topical subjects, whether they are new or whether they revisit some old ideas like No Place to Be Somebody and stuff like that. The gallery in the front, in terms of the art gallery, the lobby is an art gallery, that we have an installation of work in there now by Milton Kitsellis, who was my mentor, who was prolific and died in 2008. And so we see his works. And then going forward, we will have works of other new artists and other established African-American artists. And Milton is Greek. So, you know, it's in terms of good art, but the kind of art that is going to inspire some kid who may not have ever thought about being a painter, that he could do this as well, because he sees somebody that is like him or looks like him or lives in his neighborhood, or that it's the kind of thing that is just going to expand his thinking. One of the things that we have to really do is to determine how we define the metrics and how we define, you know, just the kind of way that we are establishing this STEAM concept, so that Northrop Grumman and places like that will find reason to want to support this facility.
Yeah, that was my question, is you know, are you looping in sponsors? Exactly. Do you create this wonderful environment where these children are mentored and given, have their eyes opened? I love how you talk about the aperture of the mind. You mentor both boys and girls. And from what I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you actually mentor them in separate groups. Is that correct or no?
Well, yes and no. My wife, Latina's Angels, you know, she is the artistic director and deals with them. But a lot of the stuff that we do is really collaborative. Like, for instance, we had a recital, and it was girls and boys, you know, and we're looking at, you know, it was really a kind of amazing experience, because, you know, it was about each individual and what their experience is in regards to singing, dancing, writing, whether it's poetry, whether it's a story, painting.
Well, right. I guess the thing is, though, creating space, both boys and girls can be motivated in different ways. And so creating spaces for them to feel comfortable, you know, for girls to not be overshadowed by maybe rambunctious boys, or places where boys are able to be rambunctious and not forced to sit down. And then bringing that, their own creative energies into one, once they've had that room to be who they are. I just think it's really interesting. And I was curious if it was a conscious decision to sort of separate and then come together, or if it was just, you know, ease of organization, like what was behind some of that?
Well, it is a separation for a fair amount of it, because I talk to boys about stuff that men need to understand, respect, appreciating, like Mother's Day, you know, what are you doing?
How are you becoming good young men? Yeah.
How are you becoming good young men? And how are you choosing respectable relationships, and how are you respecting the rights of others, and what kind of communication dialogue do you have with people? How do you become a gentleman? And then on the other hand, how do you deal with each other as boys where you can appreciate, you know, the relationships that men have with each other, you know, relationships. And then when we come together, like when we go on trips, and as one group. Sometimes the girls and boys go separately, but a lot of trips we go together because, you know, there is a mutual experience. And in the process, there is a respectability that occurs in that because, you know, you can't teach men how to become a fully rounded man without having
interaction with women in society.
Right? Exactly. So it's a mix. It's definitely a mix.
Well, you know? I'm a mother of boys, and I have to say that creating a space for boys to find that how to be a good role model of a man, you know, in the environment where there's a lot of sort of, I don't know, it's mix a lot of messages which are old and not good, but not a lot of good new messages that are concrete for them. I think it's great to have a place where you can learn how to be a solid, positive male and how to interact with women in the way we as women want to be interacted with. I think that's, and also as a creative person, as a creator, one of the things in working in creative field that I've found is important is the sense of fun and play that is inherent in a lot of the creative process. And you were talking about your school and the tools that you use. Could you share some of those things that you think that are those tools that help people open up their minds, become more creative? What are some of those things?
Well, to give you an example of a class and the way my class works. So the philosophy of my school is like it is old school teaching delivered through 21st century technology, so that all the tried and true things from going back years in terms of the tools of acting and creating good stories and good storytelling and the development of art is old school.
Can you give me some examples just so for people who could maybe benefit just a little bit who are listening, like what would be one or two examples of those old school things?
Respect for time, work ethic, the discipline required, the ability to communicate, the removing judgment, the understanding that nothing is good or bad or nothing is right or wrong in art, that it is an expression that people can... It will either, you know, it's about taste. People will either love it or they won't. And it's okay either way because you don't create it for that purpose. You create it because it's a pure expression of your own truth or your own ideas or your own imagination. Those fundamental things are very old school. You know, you show up on time, you do your best, you forget the rest. That dreams don't have expiration dates. Never let your creativity pass through the lens of someone else's morality. You know, the wrong way is the right way, meaning just start. Get started. Don't wait to have it be perfect. You know, don't wait for the right time. Now is the time. Start now and get going. Even if you're going in the wrong direction, Sir Isaac Newton said, bodies in motion tend to stay in motion. Bodies at rest tend to stay at rest. So start, you know, do it front loaded, meaning that, you know, start now, do most of the work in the beginning. So by the time on the night comes, you have done the bulk of the work. You're not trying to force, come up with ideas in the 11th hour and just make it through the finish line.
I love that. I love the wrong way is the right way and bodies in motion. I never really thought of it, but it's absolutely right in terms of going and doing and jumping.
Right. And perfection is the death of art, you know, because when people try to get things perfect, you know, there's always that question of that, well, there's always another way. And one of the things that I teach is to move forward swiftly and follow your first impression with good humor and flexibility, that you're genius. You're a genius until proven otherwise. And there's only one person that can prove you otherwise, and that's yourself. Because someone disagrees with you doesn't mean that it's not right. They see it differently. That's fine. To understand that the art that I create, once I'm done, it no longer belongs to me. It belongs to the world. Let them have it. That acclamation and condemnation are the same animal. It's just the other side of the coin.
Right. Right.
One day they love you, one day they hate you. It's okay. You know?
Do you help people understand how to internalize and cope with it? Sometimes people don't like your art, and that's sometimes very hard, and to learn how to take it. I mean, that kind of lesson. And do you talk about that with the kids?
Absolutely. Listen, you know, who I am and what I do are not the same things. I'm the creator, and what I create, it is not me. I am separate from what I create. And so therefore, you know, I do my best to create it. And this is where all those other things come in, where the front loaded, to not be perfect, to my work ethic. Because if I turned over every stone, that when I'm done, then I'm done, and I let it go. It now belongs to the world to deal with. And I move on to the next thing. So that I'm not precious about anything. So therefore, I can maintain a sanity and a clarity about who I am, and not what I do does not define who I am.
Right.
So therefore, it all is about enjoying the process. So my classes start with dancing.
Huh, that's nice.
You get there, and the first thing you do is dance. Not just dance. You dance like there is no tomorrow, like nobody's watching, so that you get out all of the day's considerations, frustrations, so that when we sit down, we are now present, and we roll up our sleeves, and we laugh, and we fight, and we cry, all in whatever it is that is going to take us to understand what we're trying to do, put 100% into it. And at the end of the evening, we dance again before we leave to celebrate the good work that we've done. So that when people leave my class, it's hard to get them to go, because they have such energy and such connection and such they want to hang out and talk and all like that. And
I was just thinking, I want to go to your class. I want to do this. This sounds fun.
It is fun. Art is fun. And it's only precious when you're in the middle of the trenches and you're digging in your soul to find the truth of the answer that you're looking for. And then when you're done, you let it go and move to the next thing, or that you come back the next day and give it a shot. So there's no bad rehearsal. There's no bad, you know, none of my rehearsals are bad.
Right, right.
Some are more productive than others, but sometimes.
That's true.
Yeah. Sometimes you're just stuck, and sometimes you have blocks, but I appreciate the block. Because I'm going to sit there and really try to work it out. And when I'm done, if I haven't moved at all, I know that I've moved a lot. Because what it took for me to just stay there with it, rather than to distract myself or to use diversion, or, you know, to justify or to get angry or, you know, to do something else, that's where I don't grow. But if I'm in it and there's no movement, that feels like it's not anyway. I'm moving through something, and I just have to be patient, and then there's tomorrow,
You know, what's really fascinating about that is you mentioned patience and sitting with it, and I'm curious how, when you're dealing with these young people, devices these days are training children to be impatient. And they're training people to get sort of immediate satisfaction, lots of hits of dopamine anytime you get a like or a share. And is that something, it's very removed. You're not necessarily dealing with people in real life. You're texting with them. So now you have these kids and you've got them in real life and they're doing these things in the present. How do you deal with devices? Do they have to put them away? How do you pull them out of those devices? Because they're very seductive and it's very hard to pull them into the present, young people.
Well, in my class, you pull out the phone. Everybody pulls out their phone, cuts it off, puts it away, and it doesn't come out until a break. On the break, you can go check your text. You can do whatever you want to do. When you come back in there, all the attention is forward. Now, I have stage managers, and their job is to make sure that the room is present, because it's present and available. So the fact is that I cannot teach through a frown. And I also cannot teach people who are not clear about why they are there. So the first thing you do when you come into my class is really the question is asked, why are you doing this? So that we look at what your purpose is. If you're clear about your purpose, then that's an engine that will never stop running.
Mm.
If you have no purpose, then you're on an adventure. If you have a purpose, then you are on a journey.
Oh, I love that. That's so great. Now, so when you're dealing with the KIPPS Academy, is this something that then children are choosing on their own to participate? Or is it something where all the eighth graders attend? Da, 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 da? How do the children who are selected, do they self-select to participate so they're already somewhat motivated and focused? Or how are they enticed into the program?
Well, we interview them. You know, and the first thing is that they're told what the program is about, and then they show an interest in like, oh, I want to do that, or they've heard about it, or their friends have been in it, and so they want to be in it too. And so we come and we talk about, you know, like, tell me about your dreams, and tell me about what you want, and tell me about what you're interested in, and what you feel about this, and we look at attitude, and we look at desire, and we look at a number of things. Attitude monitors talent. Like I said earlier, I can teach somebody, I can't teach through a frown. So sometimes somebody will come into my school and it's like this kid who just came into school. My teachers are all sharp, and one of my teachers discerned that he was on something. And so we had a second interview with him, and we were very straight. It's like, look, we want to help you, but you have to want to help yourself. And we can't, our policy is that there's no drugs or alcohol 24 hours before class, of no kind, even the psychotropic drugs. Now, if there are psychotropic drugs, because I'm a person, I have training in that area, I ran the drug program for the National Basketball Association from 1983 to 1994. I set up the program for them with some other people.
Seems so outside of all of your career. That's really interesting. How did you get involved in that?
Because I was a recovering addict and I went and got help. And then as I got help, I met people, and then they asked me, would I be interested? And then I went and got training, and I studied with John Bradshaw, who was one of the foremost people in the country in terms of the family, and John Lewis, Dave Lewis, and Kip Flock. And these guys were one of the foremost in the field, and also Rex Fine. And so I trained with them, and then we started the program. So that when I started working in the program, you know, when I entered the room, the players all knew who I was because they saw me on this show or that show or that show. And it was like, hey, man, there's a cattle on my children, or there's the guy from Dynasty, or there's the guy from Poltergeist, and blah, blah, blah. And so that allowed me to go into the room, and then I was no longer a suit. So then when I started talking about the professional aspect of it, they were open to listen, so I was very effective. And so I had all this training, and so I used that training in this teaching. And so this kid, it was really clear. It was like, look, I want to help you, and I can really help you achieve what it is you want. But you have to follow the policies of this school to the letter of the law. And if you want this, and you're clear about why you want this, we can help you stay connected to following your dream by creating a support group and helping you to manage your addiction. It's not about, there's no cure, but there is management. And because you're in a situation where somebody understands that, it's not about making you wrong. It's about helping you do the right thing for you. While you use all of this emotion and all this feeling, this hole in your soul can be productive artistically.
Right. Did he respond? Yeah. Did he participate? Did he?
Oh, he was all over it. He was all over it. And I said, listen, you know, now your parents need to know.
Oh, how'd that go?
He said, my parents do know. Well, then we have a chance to win because we're all on board and there's nobody in denial and we don't have to tell any lies because I'm lying to nobody. So, you know, I'm straightforward with them, but I'm also able to recognize the wind is coming dishonestly, you know.
So are you and Tina both really hands-on? It sounds like you are.
We are hands-on and we're still in the process of trying to create. You know, we're a year and a half in, so we're trying to create, we're always refining the structure. You know, I'm looking for somebody to become the program director who will actually be the most hands-on while we oversee.
Right, right. I was wondering, like, who is doing your program? Who is curating your shows? Who is interfacing with these children? Because there are so much. You guys are pretty busy anyway, and there's obviously so much to go into an enterprise like what you've put on.
There is. But, you know, I'm surrounded by some very able people and some very talented people and people who know what they're doing. So we are the program directors, but I'm looking for someone to become the program director who will be dealing with scheduling and will be dealing with the schedule 6 months to a year out as it relates to the Angels and Warriors. As it relates to the theater, you know, that's a different group of people. As it relates to somebody who oversees all of Waco, we have the executive director in place. They're not running the Angels and Warriors program, but they're running the overall facility, the agenda, the mission, the employees, the all of that.
So I'm mindful of our time with you, and you've been very generous. One last question, and that's what's next, and how do you broaden your vision and scale the impact of what you're starting here?
Well, that's an interesting thing. You know, again, a year and a half old, we are learning what our strengths are, and we're learning what our liabilities are, our assets and our liabilities. And
your opportunities. Don't call them liabilities. They're opportunities for somebody to help you.
Well, it is that. But, you know, you have to, you know, there's 24 hours in a day. There's 12 hours of light and there's 12 hours of darkness. And there's a completely different set of animals and characteristics that work in both. I don't see the liabilities as a negative. I see a liability as something to manage and to use to your advantage by understanding them. So it's not a negative. It's a positive for me. As an actor, I understand all of the liabilities that I have, and I use them to paint the characters, the emotion, and the dark side of my characters. And I know that the balance of both create the contradiction, which then makes us human. And so, therefore, it's not a negative at all. Yeah, so I'm just learning, like, where do we need to be stronger organizationally? How do we do that? You know, how do we scale this up where we will then need a bigger building and where we'll need a larger bus and, you know, and we need more staffing and that we're taking on more students and that we're following a program to where we set up relationships like with USC, like with New York Film Academy, like with different institutions that like USC to be able to provide tutors from students there that will be tutors for these kids that will help to enhance their grade point average. So we're looking to, in our alignment with other people and other models before us that have had successful organizations, and, you know, it was something that was something we did altruistically. But we are also discovering what we don't know and what we are learning in the process. And so it's been a fun, wonderful experience so far. when we look across the board at all the stuff that's happening, the people who leave the theater smiling because they just saw a great production, the people who look at the artwork and are blown away by the presentation as they come in, the kids as they grow, you know, and the smiles on their faces as we just took them to Cedars-Sinai and they learned about brain surgery. That was mind-blowing. And they were actually able to do a brain surgery on a brain that was a cadaver brain with a $1 million instrument that does the cutting and stuff. And so we're really enjoying what we are doing.
What an amazing opportunity for people. So if somebody wants to find out more about your organization, or if a brand wants to inquire about sponsoring the good work that you're doing, where would they reach out to and where would they find out?
At WacoTheaterCenter.com, or which would, you know, they go to our website, WacoTheaterCenter.com. They'll learn a lot there. They can reach out to me personally at Richard@WacoTheaterCenter.com. They can find out just about anything on the website in terms of they can make donations, they can seek sponsorship.
Great. Well, thank you so much. It's really amazing everything you've done. I appreciate that you shared your time, and I think that you're building something which is really interesting, and I look forward to how you're going to move forward with these vans and bringing this project even broader than where it currently is as you continue to grow. So thank you so much.
We've reached the end of another episode of Up Next, and I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media, and a big thank you to our guest, Richard Lawson. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.